I am Plata on the line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Marcello DiCintio joins me again. He has just published a fascinating book, Pay No Heed to the Rockets, Palestine in the Present Tense. He reveals a complex narrative of experiences of Palestinians, as well as offers a view onto traveling to and living in a region that has, as he reveals, a remarkable literary culture of authors and poets and their books. It looks at the day-to-day existence that's beyond dodging crossfire. Even early on in the book, as I am, you get a sense of the humanity in this place that the news media tends to simplify, if not overlook. Marcello DiCintio is the author of four books, including the 2013 Shaughnessy Cohen Prize winner Walls, Travels Along the Barricades. That book also received the City of Calgary's W.O. Mitchell Book Prize. Mr. DiCintio's essays have been published in sundry publications, including The Walrus, Canadian Geographic, The International New York Times, Condé Nast Traveler, and Afar. This new book is published by Goose Lane. He joined me from Calgary last week. Please welcome back to the Plata Online program, Marcello DiCintio. Mr. DiCintio, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So I talked to you nearly 4 years ago when Song of the Caged Bird was published. This book, I guess, is similar in terms of where it's set, but this new book, Pay No Heed to the Rockets, I mean, it's a more expanded and expansive look at that country and its people, isn't it?
Yes, yes. With Song of the Caged Bird, which was a short kind of digital book,
yeah.
I was sort of started looking at Palestine and Palestinians and life in contemporary Palestine as seen through the lens of its literary culture. And after I'd written that, I think it's like a 50-page book, I realized how much more there was to tell and how rich that route into Palestinian life was. You know, I've just barely scratched the surface in that ebook, and I thought, well, here's my way of writing a full-length book about Palestine, which I'd been wanting to do for years.
Uh-huh.
And that was, I guess, the seed that showed me that it was something worth pursuing.
Some people told you that you shouldn't write about it, though, right?
Told me that I shouldn't?
Yeah. I read a story online about Deborah Campbell saying no.
Oh, pardon, yes. When my friend Deborah Campbell, who wrote a book about Palestine years ago, when I told her that I was planning on also writing a book about Palestine, her advice was don't. And for her, it was not just for her. I mean, this is a topic that raises a lot of passion, raises a lot of anger. Deborah faced a lot of criticism when she would read from the book, and it made people angry. You know, I mean, Israel-Palestine is a minefield to write about, and I think she was just warning me that if I was going to do that, I would face some controversy.
Yeah, have you thus far?
Not thus far. I mean, we're in the early stages. The book only just came out, I think, about a month ago.
Uh-huh.
I think that my approach to it, the fact that I'm talking about, you know, life in contemporary Palestine, kind of through this door through the arts. You know, I'm talking about literary arts, and that's my way into this topic. The whole point of the book was to not address life in Palestine with the politics and the struggle head on.
Right.
I wanted to find another way in, and so that may temper people's response to it. I don't know, but you know, to be honest, that's not my concern. You know,
yeah.
I wanted to write a book that was truthful. I wanted to write a book that showed some beauty, that showed told stories about Palestinians that haven't been told before. Whether or not that angers people is honestly not a concern.
Yeah, the narrative out there about Palestine, if because there really isn't even one out there. I mean, and if there is, it's usually politically shaped or simplistic. When you went there in 1999 for the first time, what did you sense right away about the culture? I mean, it's a very nuanced people, isn't it? And they're not just protesters or the people that we see on the news throwing stuff, right?
No, of course not. I mean, and that's the thing. You know, I've always said that, you know, we only see two kinds of Palestinian here in the West, or in Canada anyway. We see the the young man, the militant, with the keffiyeh wrapped around his face, throwing a stone. Or we see the woman, you know, the older woman on her knees wailing in front of the remains of her destroyed house.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Palestinian is either a militant or a victim. And you know, I learned early on in my travels to Palestine, you know, starting in 1999, but I've gone there close to 10 times now, I think, is that the Palestinians, just like everyone else, of course, has rich, interior, complicated lives. The fact is we've kind of reduced the Palestinian to a kind of a symbol of an enduring conflict and don't see the humanity that they possess, that they of course possess.
Yeah, no, in terms of the literary scene there, I mean, is there a scene at all? I mean, is there a literary scene where there are a number of writers that are popular and that are like where, you know, they're able to go to readings and buy books?
Oh, yes, of course.
Yeah.
Of course. And it's a very active scene. I mean, there's pressures there with, censorship and the occupation and not a lot of publishing houses and not a lot of venues for publishing. But no, I mean, there's writers of all ages, of both genders. In the book, I meet teenage girls in Gaza who write short stories. And just like every other literary scene in the world, they have, you know, kind of different camps and there's a different kind of cliques of you know, poets who dislike this other group of poets, and there's rivalries and critics that everyone hates, and all that kind of same healthy back and forth that we have here in Canada and everywhere else. No, it's a vibrant scene.
So in
the Middle East, which I wrote about a little bit in my second book about Iran. You know, in the Middle East, the literary art, especially poetry, is the highest art form.
Right.
Poets and writers are very well respected.
Yeah, and we'll talk about some of the folks that you met in your time there. The rate of literacy, is that quite high? In
very
Palestine?
High.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What language do they read in?
Arabic.
Yeah, and so do you read Arabic yourself?
I don't. So the work that I did read was always in translation.
Uh-huh.
The interviews that I made with the writers was most often in English. I mean, the writers that I met were mostly, you know, well-educated folks who were able to speak to me in English. I occasionally needed a translator, a little more in Gaza than in than elsewhere. I read in English.
Yeah, now, do you get a sense, as someone who is a visitor to the place, of a sense of humor at all?
Oh, yes, absolutely. The Palestinians are very funny. They possess a great sense of humor. They see the absurdity in situations, and there's no shortage of it. They know they live in a place that is dark. You know, they're constantly dealing with the political situation. It's something that affects them, their daily lives, is affected by politics. But they joke and they laugh. The cafes are filled with laughter and humor, and there's a lot of that in their work as well. Just like writers everywhere, I mean, the people I met were wonderful characters, funny and warm and generous and talkative sometimes a little self-aggrandizing, but hey, that's we're all like that.
That's like the Canlit scene, isn't it?
Exactly.
People who are oppressed, who are in exile for a long time, as the Palestinians are, that's got to shape their identity and their sense of belonging. Certainly, their sense of belonging. Can you gauge how that's changed over the years? Because, I mean, with conflict and violence in its cycles, as you just said, that obviously can't not affect every aspect of one's identity.
Yeah, no, it does, and it affects their work as well. I mean, one Palestinian writer said to me, he goes, it's not like we're writers at a MFA program in some Midwestern university. You know, we're writing from the from the heart of conflict and struggle and all of that stuff. As far as displacement, I mean, we look at we're looking at the 70th year of what Palestinians call the Nakba, the displacement that happened in 1948, and that displacement, it may be 70 years old, but it's still felt. It's still passed down. The Nakba, as they call it, which means catastrophe, is not something that happened a long time ago. It's something that started a long time ago, 70 years ago, and continues. So that kind of displacement is in their daily life and in their work. But there's no one way to be Palestinian, right? I mean, one person explained it to me like this: that there's five kinds of Palestinians. There's a Palestinian who lives in the West Bank. There's a Palestinian who lives in the refugee camp. There's a Palestinian who lives in East Jerusalem. There's a Palestinian who lives in Gaza. The Palestinian who lives in what is now Israel. And then there's the Palestinians in the diaspora. Each group has a different sense, or their experience of being Palestinian is different than everyone else's.
Mm.
And those differences, are often financial. They have to do with freedom of movement and mobility and other kinds of freedoms. It has to do with their experience of Israelis and Jewish people in a great sense that way, but they're all different. They all have a different sense of what it means to be Palestinian.
In terms of their cultural diet, I mean, the books that they consume, are they generally from Palestinian writers? And to build on that, I mean, the film, the television that they also consume, where does that come from, say?
Well, as far as books, Palestinians will read their own writers. They also will read writers from the Gulf and from North Africa, kind of writers who are writing in Arabic.
Uh-huh.
They will read the world bestsellers in translation into Arabic also appear on the bookshelves in Palestinian bookstores for sure. As far as film, Palestine endures the same diet of Hollywood garbage that we do, that happens all around the world.
Yeah.
They're watching Infinity War right now too. So, and that's with television as well. As far as music, again, it's the thing with arts now, right? There's no borderline between culture. You know, in a lot of ways, we're all reading, hearing, and listening to the same sort of thing.
Yeah.
And Palestinians are part of that group for sure.
Is there a theater scene there at all?
Their own movies?
No, like drama, like a staged theater?
In Gaza, no. Those were taken. There's very little of that going on. But yeah, in the West Bank for sure, and especially there's these fantastic Palestinian theater groups working out of in Israeli cities, who occasionally face censure and protest by Israelis and Israeli governments, which is a kind of cultural department, but who are putting on really fascinating independent theater on stage. It's a pretty exciting time to be a Palestinian actor or playwright, especially in places like Haifa.
Mm. And I buy a lot of books, collect a lot of books. Is there room for that there? And when you mentioned that they're reading a lot, I'm wondering, do they buy their books? Do they sign them out of libraries? Are there libraries there?
There's loads of libraries. They buy books as well. There is a problem in Palestine about pirated books.
Mm.
There's a lot. That's an issue as well. It's hard to overcome. I mean, Palestinians don't make a lot of money, and not typically. And books can be expensive, and so there's a problem where anytime a book becomes popular, it immediately becomes pirated. You buy these kind of photocopied versions of books everywhere. That's a problem there too. There's also a problem that the books from Lebanon and Egypt, for example, or Lebanon and Syria and Iraq are illegal to import, and so you'll get these kind of pirated versions that are that are in some way smuggled into to the Palestinians, especially those who are living in Jerusalem.
I know we shouldn't condone piracy, but I mean, you're an author who's published more than one book. I mean, I wonder what your reaction would be if you found out that your books are being pirated so that people could read them.
You know, they, I heard a story about Mahmoud Darwish, who was the kind of the great Palestinian poet who just kind of died, I think, 10 years ago now.
Uh-huh.
And his books, I mean, he was one of the most beloved poets in the Arab languages. At one point, he was the biggest selling poet in France. And he was always okay with, he knew that his books were being pirated for Palestinians. He was fine with that. He would rather be read than bought.
Mm.
But he was a celebrity. He could afford that. So, you know, for those kind of up and coming writers or young writers who are trying to somehow make a career, it's very difficult with that sort of thing. A lot of times the only way to make a, to sell books is to have them published and sold outside of Palestine.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you mentioned, I think, a moment ago that you'd been there about 10 times over the years, since 99
yeah,
at least.
Like that.
Yeah. You taught there at one point, is that right?
Yeah, I had a month-long residency at the Palestine Writers Workshop where I taught a group of 9 students, all women, mm-hmm. as it turned out. We did creative nonfiction, like memoir writing, for a month. And, you know, that's, in a lot of ways, that experience as writer-in-residence with these writers was my first kind of window into using Palestinian literary culture as a way to talk about Palestinian life. It was really interesting that during the course of that month, because I had, like I said, 9 students, and they each did three assignments.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really curious. I didn't express it to them openly, but I was really curious on how much of what they were writing for me was going to be about conflict and politics and struggle. Like, how many stories would be about the checkpoints? How many stories would be about their grandfather lost all of the fields?
Yeah.
And I was really surprised that almost none of them were. My students wrote the same kinds of stories that I would have wrote. I write about, or other people write about here. They wrote about family. You know, one woman wrote a wonderful story about how her mother is so vain. She colors the grade of her hair too often. They told stories about. One woman told a story about losing her little brother when they went praying in Al-Aqsa Mosque, and the brother was lost for the afternoon until they found him. There was one horrible story about a woman who fought with her very conservative father, who, you know, in a rage, threatened to kill her, to stab her, and very, you know, almost none of those stories were linked to the politics, to the struggle, to what we think of when we think about Palestine. And that was one of those, you know, kind of realizations that I had, is like, look, these people have rich interior lives that run parallel to conflict and politics, and that was, yeah, that's, like I said, that was a sign that this would be a good way in.
Yeah, and it's a sign that those of us in the West need to say, listen and read and hear.
Yes, of course.
Yeah. Do you think that it'll get better anytime soon? That we will be, you know, able to look at this part of the world unlike we've looked at it heretofore?
I wish I could say yes. I'm not confident. I see very little reason for optimism. The events of the last few weeks there in Gaza have shown us that, you know, when things are on fire, they gain the world's attention for a little bit. We complain more about how the story is being covered, mm-hmm. than what is actually happening to the people involved. Not to say that discussing how the journalism is being produced is not important. It is. But we end up arguing about how a headline is crafted more than what's going on to these people.
Right.
And then, you know, in a week from now, that news will be gone, and we'll have forgotten all about it. The leadership on both sides of that struggle, there's nothing to be optimistic about that.
Yeah.
You know, there's no one coming up on either side that seems to have any good ideas. No, I'm not optimistic.
In your travels, you meet some rather remarkable, certainly interesting people, some of the notable names in the Palestinian cultural landscape. I guess having spent a lot of time there, I mean, it makes it easier to say, ingratiate yourself with that crowd, and you're able to meet these folks. There's a lesson in here about going to a place and wanting to understand it by talking to the people. Have you any insight as to how to do that, especially when it's a foreign country?
I think honestly, it's easier than people think it is.
Yeah.
I've learned this lesson, over and over in the past several years, and not just with this book, but certainly with the previous one as well, is that, people want to tell you their stories. People want to tell those stories. I mean, that's what makes us human, is that we desperately want someone to ask us about our lives. And the idea of spending a lot of time there ingratiating kind of myself to the population, I didn't need to spend much time. I found that people wanted to talk. They just want, you just got to go and do it. A lot of places that I've traveled, in Palestine in particular, the locals, not only did they treat you with great welcome and warmth and generosity, which is the case all through the Middle East in my experience, but in Palestine, they are grateful for you to come. They really want people from elsewhere to show up in their towns and villages to see what life is actually like. I received so many thank yous from people as if just being there was doing them some sort of service. Mm. It's not, there's only so much a visitor can do, but that level of gratitude I found really remarkable, and I was quite warmed by it, and I certainly don't take it for granted.
What's the food like there?
Food's fantastic. Palestinian food, I mean, it would be familiar to people who've eaten Lebanese food, it's chickpeas and lamb and shawarma and that sort of thing, but it's great. I mean Palestine has rich agricultural land, and there's plenty that grows. But yeah, the food is very good. Gaza has its own kind of twist on things too. There's obviously far more fish available in Gaza, it being on the coast. The Gazans have this weird combination of dill and chilies that they put together, I've never had anywhere else in the world, which seems to be, two flavors that would be in conflict. But man, it really works in a strange way.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I understand in recent weeks you've been traveling with this book throughout Canada, as well as in Britain. The questions that you have about your experience, are they different in that country as opposed to this one?
Well, that's a good question. Not so far.
Yeah.
Not so far. I mean, I haven't done much in Canada yet. I did a couple events in Montreal and then my launch in Calgary. I'm heading out to Southern Ontario in a few days for some more events. But I haven't seen, not a huge difference. And that's a good question because I thought that there would be. I think, generally speaking, readers in the UK are more engaged and informed on this subject than we are here.
Mm.
So the questions, are from people who I think there's more people who have been there.
Yeah.
in the UK than here. So to get questions that are a little bit more informed, I suppose. But not huge differences. You know what these things, these readings and Q&As are like. Most people, especially with a topic like this, most people don't have questions. They have commentary, and that's what you're.
Right.
It requires a level of patience and grace. I think I'm not sure I always have to kind of deal with that sort of thing. You get some naive stuff, and there was a audience member in the UK who was convinced that if only there were better protest songs, this conflict would have been over. and people were argued with her. No, she would not be persuaded. This was the solution. Yeah. She was under the impression that it was music that ended apartheid in South Africa. So we couldn't convince her otherwise.
Well, you know. I read somewhere, I think I read somewhere, I was scrolling through the internet, as one does, that someone's purchased the rights to this. Is that right? I saw something on the Quill and Choir website.
Oh, no, it was purchased. There's three editions that are already purchased. So I got a publisher in Canada. The version in the UK is from a different publisher, and it's shorter. Actually, they publish a much shorter version for some reason. And then I have a US publisher as well, and then the US edition comes out in the fall.
I see. Are you working on something? I think, have you traveled elsewhere and are working on something else at the moment?
I'm in the early stages of a new book. It's so early that I don't want to talk about it.
Sure.
But I'm doing a fair bit of magazine work as well. What's been great. I mean, the Palestine book. You know, there were writers that I didn't get to talk to. I didn't get to write about. And so I'm kind of doing that now. You know, right now I'm working on a second draft of a long magazine piece about two Palestinian poets who live in Brooklyn, New York.
Mm.
You know, I kind of wanted a chapter on diaspora Palestinian writers and didn't get to it for the book. So now I have an opportunity to write those stories, you know, in a shorter form elsewhere. I like that ability to, you know, once a book is out, to kind of fill in the gaps that you left, you know, elsewhere.
Mm. It's been a pleasure talking to you again. I'm a big fan of your work.
Thank you so much.
And I'm looking forward to finishing this book. Thanks for your time today.
Oh, my pleasure. Anytime.
The book is called Pay No Heed to the Rockets, Palestine in the Present Tense. It's published by Goose Lane Editions. Its author, Marcello DiCintio, joined me on the line from Calgary in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.